Kim, welcome back from Christmas break.
Thanks. Welcome back to you, too.
Yeah. I'm back. I don't know if I want to be back. You know, can't really take a vacation or days off because, you know, I have nowhere to go.
Yeah, exactly. It's just all one big run together.
No, but I'm excited to get back to the podcasting. We've been taking a couple weeks off with the holidays and all. So, you know, today, really excited about today because a good friend of mine, John David, is going to join us. He's from USA BMX, Chief Strategy Officer, which apparently is a promotion because he used to be the Chief Operating Officer. But, you know, it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, a little title change.
Yep. So he's going to explain BMX to us because I've already admitted to Kim that I don't know anything about the sport. It's a bike and some hills and some dirt. That's all I got.
Yeah, I don't know anything either. So hopefully good.
Yeah, hopefully he tells us what it is. So I don't even have a bike anymore. The closest I got to Peloton.
I don't think I have a bike either.
I can't tell you the last time I actually rode a bike. Like any bike.
I think college maybe for me.
Yeah, because even the last time I went to Key West on vacation.
I mean, does a recumbent bike count?
I guess so. I mean, this is how bad it is for me. I went on vacation with friends to Key West, and you can rent bikes to get around the island, and instead we rented a golf cart.
Oh, well, sounds like you.
Yeah, it's definitely me. So today our guest is John David. He's the Chief Strategy Officer for USA BMX, the governing body for BMX racing in the U.S. and Canada. He's a Louisiana native and graduate of LSU. Go Tigers. If you're ever heading to New Orleans, make sure you ask John for an itinerary for your trip. You won't be disappointed. JD got his start with BMX racing as a senior field director for the National Bicycle League before moving to American Bicycle Association as the director of new track development. In 2009, he became the COO of USA BMX before becoming the chief strategy officer in October 2020. John and I also serve on the board of directors for Sports Events and Tourism Association since 2011. He is currently the rights holder representative, my old job. He formerly served on the boards of the Arizona Sports and Entertainment Commission, the Advisory Board for Austin Convention and Visitors Bureau, and the Union Cyclist International BMX International Commissary. No idea what that is, so probably need to ask them about that. So I hope everyone enjoys the conversation with John David.
Welcome to the Pitchside from the Plex podcast, discussing all things youth and amateur sports. We are broadcasting from the Adventist Healthcare Fieldhouse at the Maryland Soccerplex with your hosts, Matt Libber and the one and only Kim Walter.
Wow, Patty, McKenzie has been playing really well the past few games.
Yeah, we have her working with MBS Performance Counseling to help her with her mental approach to the game, and we are loving her newfound confidence.
Really? Counseling? For sports?
Not just sports. We are seeing results in her schooling as well.
Seriously?
Yes. At MBS Performance Counseling, they focus on building optimism, resilience, and grit in each of their clients. McKenzie is learning the value of self-talk, visualization, and other techniques for pre-game, during game, and post-game.
Wow, that sounds super interesting. I'm going to sign Bentley up today.
MBS Performance Counseling specializes in mental and emotional training for adolescent athletes on the field and in the classroom. Through our training, players can be purposeful in their preparation and in their responses to adversity, setbacks, anxiety, fear, and doubt. Nothing has to be wrong to seek performance counseling. In fact, it is very beneficial to develop these skills to go from okay to good and good to great. Pitchside from the Plex listeners can get the online Perform with Purpose course at 40% off using the code SOCCERPLEX. Get your head in the game today with MBS Performance Counseling. Find out more at mbsperformancecounseling.com.
David, welcome to the show. How you been?
Great, man. Great. I mean, it's just so great to get into 2021 and really looking forward to a great series and truly appreciate the opportunity to chat today.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Kim and I both know absolutely nothing about BMX, so we hope you could teach us what it's about. And, you know, I'll date myself a little bit. The first real reference to BMX I have, and I don't know many people know this movie, but it's BMX Bandits, Nicole Kidman's, like, first movie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. BMX Bandits, Rad, these are some cult classics out there that kind of featured the sport. But, you know, BMX stands for bicycle motocross. It's a great sport that's been around since the early 70s. Became introduced into the Olympics in 2008 and just continues to grow. I mean, it's an absolutely spectacular sport to be a part of.
Yeah. So give us kind of the history of like how BMX started. And, you know, I was looking a little bit and it was like a bunch of guys in California, like modified bikes and said, let's race. And, you know, it kind of went from there is how I read it.
Yeah. You know, what's so cool about the history and the claim to fame of BMX is it's one of the sports that was actually for kids created by kids. You know, that's pretty unique when you think about it, you know, compared to a lot of other sports. And basically, it was kids that were, you know, boys and girls that were with their dads typically that were out at the motocross track. And their dads are out there at racing on the motocross tracks in Southern California. And they started mocking them on old Schwinn Stingrays and building little tracks on the inside perimeters of the motocross tracks. And it just kind of caught fire from there. And somebody came in and said, hey, let's sanction this and let these kids race. You know, because at that time you really didn't have a lot of mini bike racing per se in motocross. And really it caught like wildfire. And then from there, you know, several different sanctioning bodies popped up and got organized all across the United States, you know, really hotbeds in California, Texas, and Florida, and then really grew into the Northeast and the Northwest and so forth. And really for us within what was our parent company, which is American Bicycle Association, we were actually founded in 1977, right down the street from where I sit today in Chandler, Arizona. And we were founded as the Arizona Bicycle Association. And really it was a Lions Club that wanted to go out and host some events and catch part of this new fad that was BMX racing. And here, you know, 43 years later, you know, we're now the governing body, sanctioning body for BMX racing and have 50,000 members. And last year sanctioned 11,000 local BMX races.
Wow. So, and you actually started with one of the competitors, right? Before you were with the ABA, you were with the National Racing League or Bicycle League?
Yeah, they really, you know, once you kind of got in, once really the sport got formed, you know, formatted, really kind of took shape, you know, there were several different associations, as I mentioned earlier, and you really got whittled down to basically two. And it was the National Bicycle League and then the American Bicycle Association. I'm a Louisiana guy, and while I was going to LSU, worked for the Parks and Recreation Department in Baton Rouge and started running a local club there. And while I was there, that club was a National Bicycle League club. That's just what they were a part of and kind of when they got started where they were. And that's kind of was naturally with where they were situated. Well, after running that club for a couple of years, the governing body, NBL, at the time came in and said, hey, you know, we'd love you to come move to Columbus, Ohio and work for us and kind of take some of those successes of what you've done at your club and that enthusiasm you have and help us on a national basis. And it was crazy. I mean, one of the toughest but easiest decisions I've ever made. I mean, I packed everything up, moved to Columbus, Ohio. And I haven't looked back since. And I was in that role for about two and a half years. And I think I basically stirred up enough trouble with the guys here in Phoenix at the American Bicycle Association. Matt, you know me. Yep. You know I can stir up some trouble. And they finally said, hey, you need to, you know, you're too expensive for us over there. You can just come over here. And so that's kind of how it all happened. I mean, it's as funny as that. I laugh about my career path because, one, I tell everybody, like, hey, if this doesn't work out for me, I think I'm in trouble because this is all I've ever done. But, you know, so that's the one thing. But, B, I mean, it's been amazing. I mean, when I got over here, you know, in year eight of being here at ABA, the sport became an Olympic sport. In year 10, you know, we bought out the competitor that I used to work for and unified the sport under one banner. I mean, no one knows better than you guys and how challenging, you know, multiple, you know, sanctioning and governing bodies can be for a sport. That has been transformative for the sport of BMX racing, having all of that under, you know, one banner. You know, look, and here I am. I'm just some kid at the time that raced BMX and just loved it. I mean, I loved interacting with the racers and the kids and the parents. And I remember thinking when I was, you know, 18-year-old John David, I'm like, man, if I could do this for a living, it would be the greatest job done to man. And I kind of wake up every morning still feeling that way. So, I mean, I love what I do, and I'm really happy to have this opportunity.
So you raced as a kid, too.
I did. But yeah, my sister and I, you know, we got out to the local Schwinn dealership that had a BMX track in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, right behind the dealership. And man, I loved it. I mean, and I think you see this. We all do see this with kids in certain sports. It's like, they just go and they have that opportunity to play and compete. And they may try basketball, they may try football or soccer, but then boom, you know, lacrosse just hits and grabs them. And that's how it was for me. I played a lot of football, played basketball. You know, this is no surprise to you, Matt. I was always the smallest kid on the field. You know,
and you're just a little guy. It's fine.
My dumb luck. But I got on a BMX track and raced one time, and I couldn't sleep that night. I mean, I was so hooked so hard, from day one. And my dad always laughs about it. He goes, "It just hits you, man." And he goes, "That's all you thought about, slept about, you know, and dreamed about." And the rest of the again is I laugh about my career path, but the rest is history. It's just great.
Yeah, I love the story about the sport. Made by kids for kids. I feel I was lucky. That neighborhood I grew up outside of Baltimore, we had a ton of kids that grew up in that neighborhood, and we're all sports kids. Like, you know, guys, girls, didn't matter. Like, we all played sports to the point, like, you're talking about building a BMX track. Like, behind my house used to be woods, and then a townhouse community was going up, so there was just dirt being piled everywhere. Well, we made our own tracks. Like, I mean, it wasn't always just BMX, it was mountain bikes and everything else when I was coming through, but we also built our own baseball field and, you know, did everything else. So,
right.
I think that's where I think today some kids are missing out on, because everything is so organized for them. I think they miss that connection that gives them the passion that, you know, now you're, you know, how many years into BMX that, like you said, if you did something else, you wouldn't know what you would be doing because this is your life. So I think
that's an excellent, excellent point. I mean, and also it's the organization of sports. And then quite frankly too, it's the helicopter parents. You know, I mean, you guys know. I mean, what did we do? I mean, you take off on your bike, and it was like come back by dark. I mean, and yep. You know, that was it. I mean, so you know, yeah, you're able to go and get in trouble and build a dirt jump that you should never go jump or try to jump. I mean, you know, that happened every day, and it created these attachments to different sports that isn't quite the same as it is today, and that is a challenge that all these organizations we all face.
How was your first winter in Columbus? You know, since you didn't have one of them in Baton Rouge.
Oh my, look, I could tell you so many stories. It was hysterical. I mean, you gotta understand. I mean, I'm like, you know, again, I'm talking Southern Louisiana, right? I mean, I had never experienced snow. I had, you know, never experienced one day when my car door froze shut. I'm like, what do I do? You know, I mean, the people that I worked with thought that I was absolutely a complete knucklehead. I mean, I did everything wrong that you could do. You know, I mean, basically ran into a snowbank one day. I mean, everything. And then, you know, kind of like that Southern redneck in me too. I mean, I remember like an empty parking lot and I'm just sitting there doing donuts in the snow, you know, at 20 years old. And so parts of it were great. Parts of it were some tough learning lessons.
I know about that. I was in Florida, so I went to Florida State. So my first winter in Maryland was a struggle.
Yeah, I was going to bring it up that you went to Florida State, so don't have high expectations for Kim. There's not a lot going on there.
Gotcha.
Oh, goodness. He throws that in anytime he can.
No. Kim's a world traveler. She's lived, how many places now?
Yeah, I've lived in Alabama, Georgia, Florida, and then I now live in Maryland, obviously. So I'm definitely a Southern girl, so I get it.
Some good stops.
Yep. So, and I said this in the opening before you came on, but anyone that's going to Louisiana, send John an email. If you're going to New Orleans, he will put an itinerary together that is spectacular. And to the point of, like, while you're standing in line to get this food, what also you should be doing. So,
yeah. That's a pretty good list.
It was. It was very detailed. And I know my friends and I were very, very receptive of that and had a great time in Louisiana. And can't wait to go back if we can ever travel again.
I know, right? I mean, I'm so proud of my roots and where I'm from. And it's such a great culture down there. And you're going to, you know, if you do have an opportunity to go to New Orleans or Southern Louisiana, you'll just meet some of the greatest people. But, you know, I take great pride. I mean, and again, I think being a sports tourism professional, it's my travels a lot. I take great pride when my friends are going somewhere that I know well, of trying to go and go really, really detailed into it. I like to give you a little history. This list that Matt's talking about, I mean, it talks about, hey, the Sazerac Bar at the Roosevelt. You know, when you get there too, you know, ask the bartender to give you some details about how the drink got started and stuff. And I think those little opportunities and sharing that knowledge and that passion is, I mean, that's what it's all about. Yeah. Anybody ever going down that way, let me know. I've got a great little text. I'll shoot you, and it'll definitely give you some hot spots.
Yeah, and you'll definitely eat well off of that list. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to Louisiana, you got to eat well.
Yeah. It's hard not to.
Exactly.
So you're now the chief strategy officer. I didn't know you got the pay grade upgrade there in October. So what exactly does that mean?
Well, really what it allowed me to do, you know, as we've made some management modifications and adjustments here in, at the office, is, you know, I've really been deeply into the operations of the company. And we just have some great staff, you know, now that have come in and they're taking care of a lot of the operations. So it really has given me the opportunity to structure more on and focus, I should say, more on strategic planning. You know, and that's a lot of what I've been diving into. And again, with some of those operational tasks removed from my plate, you know, I can really get into some in-depth conversations and in-depth analysis on, you know, strategically what we do in 3, 4, and 5 years and what we do next year. And that's been fun for me. I mean, I'm a junkie in Excel. I mean, and the guys into my office, you know, they just laugh at the stuff that I come up with. They're like, how long did you spend on this? And I'm like, but look, you changed this number. Look what happened. You know, and there's just getting that data, analyzing that data, and coming up with unique, you know, concepts and ideas that can help impact the company. That's been fun for me. And it's always something that I've been able to do somewhat, but really I'm really doing a lot right now. And it's exciting. And I mean, we have some initiatives coming down the pipeline, you know, for the next 5 years that I think are going to be absolutely transformative. I mean, one of those is, you know, the sport of freestyle. And when we say USA BMX, we traditionally focus on and have always been a BMX racing organization, meaning that all of our events that I mentioned, everything else is strictly BMX racing, just that one discipline. But there are multiple disciplines of BMX. It really paints with a very wide brush. And one of those is freestyle. Well, freestyle will be debuted, you know, in Tokyo in the Olympics. And so there's been a need to come out and organize freestyle on an amateur level by nature, because it because of the sport really was not structured, was not organized. And we now just hosted the very first, actually at Woodward, Pennsylvania, the very first national championship, amateur national championship for freestyle.
Tell everybody, explain what freestyle is.
So freestyle racing, there's a couple of different versions of it, but for what we're doing is really what's considered what's called park. And it's like, if you imagine a skate park, it's probably the best visual. And so we've got riders from 5 years old and up. They go to, you know, BMX parks. And I mean, and they're just incredible. They're doing, you know, flips and tricks and twists and everything, you know, in between. I mean, and some of the vernaculars, I mean, that you would just, you'd be blown away by it. But, you know, they're incredible. They're these incredible athletes that train extraordinarily hard, that love to do their runs and the freestyle techniques throughout those runs. And there's this need to go and sanction it and organize it. And we had the first event and did it in December, you know, in Woodward, PA. And you know, we had participants, you know, from 26 states that showed up to participate in the event. And we have a plan to grow this side, you know, of this division of the business and that sport on an amateur level that I think is just going to blow people away. And I really can't wait for it too, to go into that sports tourism world that we know so well and bring this new event that we've never had before to the table. And it's going to be, hey, come and grow with us, because this is going to be something exciting.
Yeah, and I definitely know why we're such good friends, because I'm that Excel junkie too. And, you know,
I've seen some of your work. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, when I was at Elite, I built a, you know, economic impact calculator in Excel that met our needs, because we didn't find something that, you know, was representative of what we did. So I definitely feel you on that one and using that data for good. And like, I love those formulas where you're like, I just put one number in A1 and everything else builds out. Like makes me happy.
No, exactly. You know, and it's all good stuff. So the strategy part of it has been great. I mean, it's just been a great focus. And I think that's really honestly what, you know, a lot of people say, man, how are you at one place for 20 years now? Because this is my 20th year, you know, at American Bicycle Association. And the answer is it's been easy, to be honest with you. And the reason why is because every few years there's been a new challenge that I've been able to have some autonomy within the company, develop the process and system, you know, and then develop the business unit. You know, for example, you know, in 2003, we started our Canadian operations. You know, we do the same stuff in the United States as we do in Canada. I have the brand BMX Canada. You know, I created the BMX Canada National Series and went up to Canada, you know, 8 times a year running that for several years, you know, before some of the other team members came in and took that over and have done such a great job with it. So there's always been in my career these new challenges within our sport and our business that have needed to be developed and grown. And I've just been so lucky and fortunate that I've been allowed to do those things. It's kept me excited and sharp. It's sports tourism was one of the greatest impacts for our company. You know, and when we dove into it, you know, in 2010 and started getting serious about, hey, how do we activate ourselves in the space, which we'd never done before? You know, it transformed our company. I mean, it completely transformed our company. I mean, at first, it was like, wow, look at all these benefits of partnering with sports commissions and CBBs. And this is unbelievable. And look at what we're now able to do. But then we realized really quickly that when we're wanting to grow our sport, one of the key ways to doing that is to develop new BMX tracks. Well, a lot of times we'd have an enthusiast in town that's a BMXer, but we could not convince Park and Recreation or the city to get enthused about BMX racing. Well, however, at a sports tourism conference, Matt and I were sitting there talking to so-and-so, and I talked about BMX until they just got so sick of me that they wanted to build a BMX track. And so now we plug those things together. And we literally, because of sports tourism now, are building more new BMX facilities across the country than ever before. And 9 times out of 10, too, they're coming out fully funded, you know, where there's these amazing BMX facilities that are hosting major events. We're backstopping them with events. So it's so much more than just going out and trying to find a great partner for a good event. Now it's about growing that sport. So it's just been so incredibly fun to be able to learn those things, figure those things out, see these opportunities and try to capitalize on them. And at the end of the day, I'm benefiting a sport that I know means the world to me.
Your well-being can't wait. Adventist Healthcare is here to help you get your health and well-being back on track. Make this year your best one yet and take the first step towards better health. Even small steps can make a big difference in your health. Get in extra steps by taking the stairs or parking farther away. Drinking more water and eating one extra fruit and vegetable every day are all easy ways to get started. Don't forget to check in with your primary care doctor and see what preventive checkups you may need this year. Get back to better with Adventist Healthcare. Find your trusted primary care doctor or a location near you at AdventistMedicalGroup.org.
Talking about building tracks, what's it cost to actually build a track these days?
You know, it's always my favorite question. I tell everybody, well, it's like building a house. You know, how big's your house? You know, I mean, is it, you know, we building, you know, 1,000 square footer with no yard on, you know, a half acre, you know, or are we building, you know, a 3,300 square foot house? Really, that's a true analogy. You can, you know, if we're going into an existing park, we've already got infrastructure, lighting, power, everything else. Really, it's not that expensive. I mean, for $150,000, you know, the dirt can be imported and sculpted, fencing can be constructed, power connections made, things like that. To build a full-on national caliber BMX track that can host national events, that gets, you know, into the close to $1 million, you know, which honestly, very honestly, comparatively to most other features within a park, and again, with what you're doing there at the complex, you know, this is as well as anybody, you know, that's not that big of a price tag. We do have facilities that are just absolutely world-class. You know, we partnered with Janice Burke, with the Houston Sports Commission to build the Rockstar Energy Bike Park. The bike park in total was about a $28 million bike park. The BMX facility was, that's one of my favorite stories ever. But the BMX facility in itself was just under $8 million. And it's, you know, that's why without a track ever being constructed, she went out and won the world championship bid, you know, and they have national events now. So it's this world-class BMX park that people absolutely adore in the community, and it services their needs. They've got international athletes moving to Houston and living in Houston to train there. And they've got this great racing program that services the local community, but then also is backstopped by great economic development from events. So it's a win-win across every segment that there is with it's important to a community.
What kind of footprint does a track usually take up? So like give me a you know, normal track and then give me the Houston track. What the footprint size of that?
Normal track's actually within an acre, you know, so it's a pretty condensed footprint. The Houston one's about, I think it's 2.5 acres in total.
It still seems so small. I mean, a soccer field's almost 2.5 acres. So it just, it doesn't seem that big to me.
You know, it's really not. I mean, the footprint's not that big, and it's funny. You know, you all in business, you learn these things that sometimes help people get convinced to make a decision. I mean, I can't tell you how many city councils that I've convinced to build a BMX track by saying this one last statement. I would close out by saying, hey, listen, guys, at the end of the day, if for some reason it doesn't work, it's only dirt. all we've done is import dirt. So, I mean, you can always flatten it down and build something else. You know, they kind of look at me and they're like, that's okay. Yeah, great point. Yeah, let's do this.
Yeah, we should try that, Kim. We have very expensive grass. Like, you can put that in your front yard if we don't work out.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
So, and I think I've told you this before. We share a property with the South Germantown Recreational Park, and we're, I think, 700 total acres. And the soccer plex is only about 160 of that. But on the property is actually a pump track. And I know that's not quite BMX, but, you know, can you explain to people what the pump track is? Because I don't think most people realize what it is. And
I don't know what the pump track is. And it's
Sure. So, you know, pump tracks are really, you know, this new kind of probably in the last 5 to 10 years, kind of a newer creation. You had skate parks and bike parks that really kind of exploded. Almost every park has a concrete skate park or whatnot. Well, one of kind of the conundrums is a skate park, most of the time, they really don't want a bicycle on it. They're designed for skateboards and scooters, you know, so then they got into building bike parks. Well, the bike parks are kind of extreme to a degree, and they wanted something that was just kind of more flow riding, you know, but didn't have to be really maintained. So a lot of communities have gone out and built what are called pump tracks. And they're like mini single track, like very similar to a BMX track in what the little obstacles are, a little smaller scale down, and they're typically asphalted or concreted, you know, and the rider just, you know, what they call it pumping because they kind of pump with their hands and knees, you know, they move through. They typically don't jump very much through a pump track. It's really just about staying on the ground. But it's just a blast. And I mean, the kids, when you go to a pump track and you see them on it, I mean, it's like bees, you know, all around. I mean, they really, really enjoy them. So smaller footprint than what we do. There are some competitions that are taking place on pump tracks. You know, you're seeing some stuff that's kind of popping up, and you're seeing some racing that's taking kind of place on a time basis and things of that nature. So pump tracks are great assets to communities. And again, for us within the BMX world, I mean, anything that gets a kid outside on a bicycle, we are 100%, you know, behind. In a lot of communities, we actually have helped them to go out and develop pump tracks, doing the design and the construction.
Yeah, our pump track is actually dirt. So that's why when I first saw it when I got here, I was like, oh, we have a BMX track. And then I realized it's not.
And you see those too.
Yeah. But I mean, talking about that, I think the craziest, one of the crazier things we've seen coming out of COVID was we're in a county that was shut down pretty much from March. But the Parks Department refused to close the parks because they still want to give opportunity for people to come out and do it. And one of the huge benefactors of that was the pump track. So last year, you know, 2019, you would maybe see, what do you say, Kim, like 5-6 people a month maybe show up at the pump track?
Yeah, I think the parks would have one big event each year, but in between that event, it was just like little kids.
But during like the quarantine and, you know, the shutdown where kids weren't in school, it got so busy at the pump track, we had to ask the parks to put up a barrier to the roadway so people would stop driving down the road because it was actually the walking path. It was one of the hiking paths for the park. And, like, there was multiple times people called our office because they think we run it. And they're like, I almost got hit by a car because somebody was driving down to your bike track. I'm like, well, that's not us. Let me get you to the right place. So they had to put a barricade up because that's how popular that bike track got over this break.
Yeah, you know, I mean, statistically, outdoor recreation has seen numbers that they just haven't seen in decades. You know, I think we can all see it, specifically in the bike industry. I mean, bike retailers are up almost 20%. I mean, they've had some of the best years that they've had in decades. And in our industry, you know, within the bicycle industry, it was needed. You know, you've had just over years and years and years of a shift in, you know, in society. I mean, so many kids these days, we're talking about this earlier as kids, just getting on a bike and going out all day. I mean, what do kids do these days? I mean, my own kids, they lock themselves in their room and they're on their phones. I mean, they're on, you know, they're on their gaming devices. They're on things like that. I mean, they're not getting outdoors like they once were. And if I think what we're going to look back on in history and see that one of the greatest crazy side benefits, you know, of COVID-19 is going to be outdoor recreation. The kids and families have renewed their love for the outdoors and going outside and doing something because they just feel stuck. I mean, they can't do many of their other activities. for us. I mean, it has been the most bizarre year. You know, we, as I mentioned earlier, we sanction annually, usually on average of 11,000 to 12,000 local BMX races, which is a staggering number when you think about it, across 320 BMX tracks. Well, we lost about 3,200 sanctioned events this year. However, the tracks that did open and operate were able to find a way. We did a lot of different things to help tracks get up and operational. We completely changed our formats. We went to these block style events where only age groups at a time would participate to stay under, you know, gathering limits and things of that nature. But the tracks that were able to open and operate are operating at about 26% higher average participation rate than before. This is the craziest thing ever, too. We have 1,300 more members today than I did this time last year.
I mean, that makes sense to some degree. I mean, if you think about it, the pandemic, I feel like bicycling and even racing to some degree is probably safer than a lot of sports. I mean, particularly we've had a lot of issues with basketball here and how, I mean, obviously the face-to-face contact with basketball is obviously high risk, but it seems like BMX would probably be the benefactor to some degree because it's not as high risk a sport. Is that the case?
You nailed it, Kim. I mean, and that's when you look at our COVID-19 plan, I mean, operational plan for big events and for even local racing, that's exactly what it outlines. It really compares and contrasts our sports to other sports. You know, here we are, we're an individual participation sport. Maximum on a field of play, which is typically an acre and a half, is eight people. You know, I mean, so it honestly was not that difficult if you could get to reasonable people to take a look at our sport and say, hey, we can do this very, very safely. Our participants don't come in teams. They come in family pods, which we can make them stay together in their family pods. And so while other sports were unable to operate in most cases, in 2/3 of the cases for BMX racing, we were able to operate. You know, and did so safely, you know, and successfully. And I mean, in internally for us, it's like, okay, you know, 2021, you know, we're working extraordinarily aggressively with our local clubs on marketing and promotions to get out and get those and spread that word out to get people who can't go participate in other traditional sports, but can come to their local BMX track in a big, beautiful park, you know, and have a fun time and enjoy themselves as a family. And people are falling in love with our sport. I tell everybody, if you come out and you try it, and you see these 2 and 3 year olds on balance bikes like Flintstones running around the track, and then in the next heat, you've got the 55 and over class where you've got two grandfathers that are there because their grandson or daughter is racing. If you go in and feel that and touch it, it's exciting. I mean, and one of my favorite stories from this year was we got to go to some places for national events that we wouldn't normally have the opportunity to host. And one of my dear friends in sports tourism is Josh Todd in Omaha, Nebraska, in the sports commission. He's just one of the all-around great guys. Used to be here in Mesa. And I called Josh. I'm like, look, we got a problem. I mean, I've gone through 4 venues. I can't get an event held. Can we do one in Omaha? This is a BMX track that in no way, shape, or form had any business hosting a national caliber event. You know, Josh got his partners together, got everybody together, activated with the club. I mean, they completely, in 45 days, revamped their facility, made it national caliber, we hosted an event. My favorite part of the entire thing is when I got to talk to Josh and his team, and especially Lindsay over there who works for him, who's just amazing. I got to be her mentor at Sports ETA when she first got into the game, and somebody who I really, really respect. And I said, okay, Josh, Lindsay, you heard me talk about BMX. You heard me pontificate. You heard all my stuff. I'm like, now that you've lived it, what do you really think? And Lindsay was so funny because she's like, okay, look, I got to tell you, I just didn't get it. I didn't get it at first when you would explain it and talk about it. Didn't make any sense to me. I knew you were real passionate about it, but I just didn't get it. And she goes, after doing it, she goes, I'm completely in love. She goes, it's so unique. I mean, it's so crazy to see families where mom and dad race and their 2 children race. She goes, it's so unique in that respect in this multi-generational participation. And she goes, I'm your biggest fan. Just anybody that wants that you're trying to sell it to, have them call me. And those are some of the stories of for me of COVID that you grab onto, you hold onto, and it just really, really what it's all about is finding the positives among a sea of negatives.
Yep, I love Josh Todd too. I got some good Josh Todd stories, yeah. But they're not safe for this podcast, so we'll save them for another day. I'm sure he'll be very appreciative of those stories too. I'm sure. But we also, I mean, I feel you on that level as far as trying to explain people what you do, but they don't get it till they show up. So, I mean, I've had that a couple of times in my career. So we had, you know, somebody that was always wanted to build a complex and give his kids an opportunity to play and things like that. But he never really understood like the business side of what it takes to run an event. So we invited him one time and said, come watch our events. And he sat in that room for two straight days and just observed. And like afterwards, he's like, I'm taking your whole team to lunch on Monday because I've never seen people work like that for a weekend where they're putting 14, 15 hour straight days in and don't complain and do what they need to do and handle it with class. And he goes, this is amazing that people do this. It's like, you know, we've been doing it for 20 years. Like it's just the way it is. And then we have the same thing with, you know, people have never been to the Soccerplex. I mean, we're a massive facility. Yep. And, you know, we have 24 soccer fields alone, plus you add in a swim center and a pump track and an archery range and all this other stuff. And people just don't get how big this place is. And, you know, we've had issues in the past where we've hired somebody and, you know, they're coming from across the country and they get here and they're like, oh, I didn't know I was getting into this. Like, this is overwhelming. I can't do this. So, like, now if you want to come work here, you got to come visit us and actually step foot on this campus and see what we do. And then it scares some people away. But then also people are like, yeah, this is it. This is the top. This is what I want to do. So it's I feel what you're saying when you, Lindsay's like, oh, I love this now, because you have to see it to believe it.
You do. And I think that, I mean, you bring up such a great point about the dedication of sports professionals, you know, that are out there and what they do. And our staff here, man, I mean, what these guys have gone through COVID-19, through furloughs when it's all hit and basically everything stopped for us. I mean, I can't say enough about the people that work in these halls. I mean, they are some of the most motivated, charismatic, excited people that love their sport. It is their sport. Most of our team came from the sport and raced BMX, or their kids race BMX, or there's this deep passion to it. And to your point, Matt, I mean, you know, I got married a couple of years ago, and my wife, you know, came to one of the events. And you know, she heard me talk about the events and everything else. And while we were dating, she came to one of the events, and she's like, this is insane. She's like, you left the door, you know, at 5 a.m. and like you got home at 10:30. And she goes, who does this? I mean, why would you do? I mean, why would you? This is terrible. Who wants to work this hard? And I'm all, baby, but that's the thing. It's not work. You know, it's just, it's not. I mean, you're participating in a sport that you're passionate about and you believe in. And when you're a sports event junkie, you just do it, you know? And I mean, and it certainly, I mean, you guys know, Kim and Matt, you know, it makes you dysfunctional for every sporting event you go to.
Yes.
I mean, I sit there and everything I attend, I'm like counting heads on security. I'm looking at this or I'm looking at that. So yeah, not only is it just crazy to the outsider, but I mean, this certainly does make you somewhat dysfunctional to attend any other type of function.
Yeah. I remember the first big event that I ever got to go to through contacts with the sports tourism world is, remember Courtney that used to be at Scottsdale before Erica was there? Do you remember?
Yeah.
So she took us to the Fiesta Bowl, and you know, we're walking around what was then University of Phoenix Stadium, and like we're pointing out like, hey, this is where this is. And she's like, are you here to watch the game or like, you know, do a site visit for the stadium? And I'm like, site visit for the stadium. I was like,
I think because you're learning, right?
Yeah.
You're learning. You're wanting to know, I mean, okay, how are these guys doing this for ops, or where's this situated, or what are they doing? I mean, and that's when you're in our roles. I mean, that's what you become. I mean, and it's fun.
Yeah, I've told the story.
Yeah, none of us are quite right.
Yeah, I've told the story a couple times, and I had just gone through training through FEMA and Homeland Security for event security and things like that. And you know, me and Mike, my brother, have season tickets to the Ravens, so I'm waiting for him inside the stadium, inside the gate, for him and my nephews to come in. And while I'm standing there, like I notice there's a gap in security. Like there's a fence that's not together, and people are just walking through, not scanning tickets, not going through the metal detectors. And I'm sitting there going, do I say something, or does that make me like the weird guy that's watching security and then I'm the problem? And it's like,
right.
Like,
you're
like
the football game. Just walk over there and reconnect the fence. Yeah.
I'm surprised that you didn't turn into security, that you weren't like, oh, let me.
I didn't say I didn't.
Where's your ticket, sir?
Yeah. He reconnected the fence.
So before I even worked here, Kim and I had met. So we both worked for Terry Hasseltine in Baltimore for a Gold Cup event at the Raven Stadium, and that's how Kim and I had first met. And you know, she has the same personality I do, that we're just going to do what has to get done, and like it's not our job, but you know, you see a gap in something, like I'm just gonna go fix it. And like, so when I took this job here and she was working here, I was like, all right, I have somebody I can rely on. Like I don't have to worry about this. She's running events. I can go home. I don't have to work on Saturdays and Sundays anymore. So
there you go.
So
it's me working the 5:30 to 10:30 shift. So I get that.
I'm partially retired now. It's fine.
Yeah.
The Pitchside from the Plex podcast is supported by the Soccer Association of Montgomery. SAM Soccer provides developmental and educational soccer programs in Montgomery County, Maryland. SAM offers classes, clinics, and leagues for children 2 to 18. Every game is a home game at SAM Soccer. All programs are played at the prestigious Maryland Soccerplex. Check out our website, samsoccer.org, for more information.
As the events person here, and I always like to hear everybody else's story. So what's the craziest thing that's happened at a BMX event that you can think of?
There's been over the years, I swear, it's like you think about stuff and you're like, you know, I've pretty much in 20 years, I've seen it all.
Yeah.
But there's some funny ones and stuff that you can't expect. I mean, we were at an event one time in Texas. You know, and the race is running, we're going like clockwork. I mean, you know, it's that moment when you tell yourself, dude, man, things are going smooth.
Yeah.
You know, and when you do go to our events, it is a lot of kids, a lot of little kids. And so when they're not on the track and racing, they're playing, you know, and we were one in behind the bleachers, you had a bunch of the kids like playing kickball and kicking a ball around. One of the kids pounds the kickball into the field of play, hits a little girl right in the head and knocks her off her bike.
Oh, and I'm like, my goodness.
I mean, first of all, I'm like, how the hell did that kid just clear the bleachers with the kickball? You know, and all of a sudden, race stops. We have this huge protest because, you know, he had complete outside interference. We had to rerun the race. You know, naturally, the kid that won, you know, that kid's dad is the biggest dad you've ever seen. You know, he's, you know, furious that we've got to rerun a race. But this other poor little girl, you know, got hit in the head with a kickball that came, you know, from outside the field of play. And there's no, you can't plan for that. I mean, that's just the weirdest, you know, thing ever. So we've seen stuff like that happen. We had one where a rider was near the bleachers and, you know, just holding a little helmet and watching some races and just accidentally the helmet dropped and it like rolled right into the start of a race. You know, and took out three riders from an 8-year-old helmet. You're like, what just happened? I mean, you know, and then there's the funny stuff. I mean, kids do some funny stuff. I mean, you know, we've had kids zip tie, you know, Porta John's clothes with other kids in them, you know, and you go to the bathroom. Oh, I mean, just, you know, cantankerous type stuff like that. So we've seen it all. I mean, we've seen it all from crazy stuff on the field of play to just funny, you know, kind of stuff at the end of the day, you know, you can sit back and laugh about. One of the great things I will say about our team is that we own and operate 52 events annually. And of those, 30 are domestic national series events. And the guys, Bill Morris, Chris Luna, Cody Wilson, and all of our staff, you know, Brad and Bill and everybody else that run events, they've seen almost everything. So luckily, there's very little learning on the fly to where when you get in that weird, bizarro situation of a kickball hitting a kid where it's, okay, hold on, that's official intervention. You know, that's something that outside the field of play, interfered with the race, that's an automatic rerun. You know, hey, go talk to the parent, explain what we're doing. Let's reset them. We're going to do them in 3 events after this. So we can recover pretty quickly, you know, from it. And we're thankful for that. I mean, there's always fun stuff that occurs at our events in Vegas. We do 2 events every year inside a hotel and casino. That's the South Point Arena. If you've never been there, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's got this 6,000 seat arena where we hold our race in, attached to a phenomenal hotel with great restaurants. It's got an 84 lane bowling alley. I mean, it's just a 16 screen movie theater, perfect place for kids. Well, we had one of our BMX dads that just, you know, was enjoying Vegas a little too much and like broke into one of the restaurants and managed to take a cart, like a full, like 6-foot tall cart of like, you know, Italian delicatessen. It was like cheesecakes and tiramisu and rolled it through the casino up to his suite. And it was like, the Cookie Monster because there were these trays of cannolis and like half-eaten the food from this drunk guy that had pushed a cart through. And it's like one of the hotel's like funniest stories ever that this guy somehow made. They don't, you know, we don't know how he got a hold of this tray of food and just drunkenly took it through the place. But
that's definitely one, you know, of the top 10 best stories I've ever heard.
Apologetic, paid for everything, but it's like, what? Are you kidding me?
I mean, that's, I'm surprised you went for the cookies. Like, most people go for like the bar.
No, yeah, he was. It must have been after the bar. He needed the cannoli. Yes. So, I mean, there's hilarious. That's probably my all time funniest, you know, that one. And again, the guy was incredibly apologetic afterwards, paid for everything. The hotel, you know, he made good with those guys and with us. And, you know, for the most part, it's things like that. So those are some of my top three.
You're talking about like emergency plan and things like that. And I think this is one of those tough things where, you know, we were talking earlier where kids just going out and playing is a great thing. But then when you do go to events like this, it needs to be professional. I think the industry as a whole has gotten a whole lot better than that. But I remember me and you doing a class about emergency planning and like asking the question, how many people have an emergency action plan? It was like two people in the room raised their hand. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, how are you not prepared for this? Because you're right. Like, you can't plan for a kickball to be over a fence, but you can plan for an interrupted race and you just apply what happens. And it's shocking sometimes when you talk to these people and they're like, oh, we don't have an emergency action plan, or we don't have a contingency plan. And it's like, well, how do you run events? Like, I just don't get it.
When you asked that question in that class, like two people raised their hand, I was like, whoa, okay. Well, let me change my tone a little bit, my thought process as we teach this.
Yeah. And the two people that raised their hand was volleyball and fencing because they just went through the active shooter in Houston or Dallas like the year before. So like they were the two that had it because they like, oh, well, we have to do this now. And like everyone else was kind of sitting on their hands and like, oh, we're in trouble.
Those touch points that we kept talking about is, you know, when you have enough experience, you can get away with that. You know, but the moment when some things shift that you haven't experienced before, or the moment that you've got some staff changes is when you're gonna be susceptible to some problems, you know. And those emergency action plans, I mean, are vital. I mean, and you have to have them in place. And again, and we're really lucky with our team. I mean, they have that experience. We have the plan in place. You know, and we've fought through some pretty challenging, you know, problems. But it happens. I mean, there's stuff that you get surprised by, and you know,
like a pandemic.
Like a pandemic.
I speak from honestly on my side. I used a lot of what I've already done in emergency action planning to develop our COVID plans because there's things in there that were relevant, and we took it from one and made it apply to something else. And you know, I think that sped up our recovery a little faster, and we were prepared to go the minute we were allowed to be open.
And that's what, when we really sat down and started cramming out the plan, there were so many assets that were already there that were built in that just addressed the issues that we had to address. And, you know, who would have ever thought? I would have never thought that I would be speaking to, you know, instead of speaking to sports commissions and things that we were only doing with our sports tourism hat and world, that I'm speaking to public health department officials and explaining why our sport can be safely hosted. I would have never anticipated that. You know what, for me though, it was, you know, I love that chip on the shoulder. I love that challenge. That's what I get up for every day, you know, and it really, you know, got me, you know, sparked me and got me going to push. I'm like, no, we're figuring this out. And I'm here to tell you, we hosted 23 national events, all of which averaged anywhere from 700 to 1200 athletes. And then again, and that's typically with all the moms and dads accompanying that. So, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 people events all across the country. And did them successfully and did them well. And we had great partners that believed in us that would go to bat for us too with their county health departments. And, you know, we're really proud of what we got accomplished in 2020. And I think we saved our sport. I think if we had just been totally shut down, you know, our sport would have suffered greatly. And instead of that, we're poised to reopen, you know, in 2021 and to do great things this year. And honestly, I think 2021 and 2022 will be some of the best years ever for the sport of BMX.
It's good to hear. I mean, I can tell you from the soccer standpoint, we're still struggling. And obviously we have different challenges. We're a team sport and, you know, it's more people are involved. I mean, you're, you know, what, 3,000 people between athletes and participants. I mean, that's like one field for us over a course of a day. So it's different challenges. And I think there's things I love about being in Maryland. There's things I hate about being in Maryland. And I think we've had some more struggles from a political standpoint than I think a lot of other places have. And we've put it together great plans to get people back out safety. And we've actually proved we could do it because we did it for quite some time. And then we were the victims of some political decisions that just said, okay, everything stopped. And it wasn't, you know, a case-by-case basis. And, you know, we're still fighting that battle. And, you know, it's again, I like the challenge too. It sometimes I Kim will tell you, I'm beating my head against the wall and I'm super frustrated and nobody wants to be near me. But when we get that little victory and, you know, I could say, hey, we're doing this because of what I've done or what we've done here as a group or what plans we put together. You know, that feels good too. I think a lot of people have leaned on the Soccerplex because we are kind of the pillar of the community and of soccer in Maryland. And I think that's helped our reputation. And we've actually seen it. Our 2021 calendar is booked so solid that we're just turning people away now. You know, our groundskeeper's like, we can't do this. Like, we have to grow grass at some point. And we're like, eh, we'll figure it out. So, I mean, we even pushed up yesterday. We're like, so can we add another weekend at the end of the year? You know, it's like a full 2 weeks after we're supposed to close the fields. But, you know, can we add that weekend? He's like, no. Like, we are not doing it. So that's my battles now, is trying to find more time in the world.
Yeah, I think the other big takeaway is, you know, and you and I personally have talked about this, is that so much of our industry with events and sporting events and sports tourism is all about relationships. And, you know, guys like Terry Hazeltine, I mean, we hosted an event in Annapolis and had a great national event. I mean, and look, I would tell you this, 2 days before, we didn't know if it was going to happen. You know, we didn't tell the public that, but I mean, that was some stuff that came down the pipeline because of some of the changing politics. But man, I mean, Terry went to bat for us. I mean, Terry used political capital and he, because of the relationship building and the past history of events, he could confidently go to city officials and county officials and say, look, I know these people. If they're telling you they're going to do this, they're going to do it. They're good people. I believe in this event. Let them host the event. And that has truly been what has happened community after community after community, whether it was Josh Todd in Omaha, whether it was Greg Fonte and Carl Schmidt in Louisville. You know, these guys went to bat for us because of the relationship building that we've done over the years and because of the friendships and the partnerships that we've built. And they were able to constantly tell their community leaders, listen, these guys host good events. They host safe events, trust them, believe in them, and you can do it. And in most places where we were the first one to host an event. You know, we were the ones. In Louisville, Kentucky, we were the first one to host an event. And we were the first actual, you know, national sanctioning body or governing body that hosted a major national event once COVID hit. I mean, when we did our first event in June, no one had hosted an event. We did an event in Oklahoma that attracted 800 athletes from 36 states, you know, and we were the first major national event to occur. And man, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that. Our team was able to, you know, work, you know, together to create that plan, to create the confidence within the community and to create the trust of the customers to come out and host a great event. And people had an absolute ball. I've never had so many people tell me thank you in a given weekend hosting an event. And they're just so happy to have some normality in their lives and be able to go outside and do something and compete. You know, kids want to compete. They want that. They strive for that, you know. And to me, so many more, you know, victories than losses due to COVID. I mean, I'm heartbroken for so many people that have lost family members and throughout this process. But I'm so happy that within our little space and peace, we've been able to bring some normality to many families.
Yeah, I mean, we got a lot of that, too. We were kind of one of the first out of the gate over the summer to get programming back up, and we did like a small-sided league. And, you know, we were going strong for a couple of weeks before the county said, no, we can't do it anymore. But I think we got one negative email out of it, and everyone else was like, oh, my God, I can't believe we shut this down. My kid was having a blast. Like, we felt it was so safe. So, that was one where we felt really proud about what we did. And again, I think we had some wins, too. I think the biggest win – like I saw is we somehow combined 90 plus soccer organizations that normally hate each other and like can't get along, don't speak to each other. And we form like a co-op, and like we are still going strong. So we're still putting information out. We had coaches from one club providing online training, and they're just like making it public so other clubs could use it so they could give it to their kids. And like, that is something that, and especially in the soccer world, is not existing beyond COVID, and somehow we're still getting it together and we're still meeting and, you know, still sharing advice and resources. And, you know, I think that's something that if we can keep that going, it at least gives us something to say, hey, it wasn't completely bad, the pandemic. There were some things that turned out well. And
it could benefit the sport as a whole.
Yeah. I mean, it's given the clubs and the players more of a voice where they didn't have it, and, you know, a more unified front. And, you know, some of the things we're talking about doing is, you know, all these clubs combining and doing scholarships so kids can pick whatever club they want to play for and cost is taken out of the issue, or, you know, lobbying for better fields or more, you know, reasonable field rental costs and things like that. That when one club's asking for it, it doesn't mean a whole lot. But when you have, you know, 200,000 kids that are now represented by these 90 clubs and they're making the request, people start listening now and they're like, oh, okay, like you guys have voting power, so we should probably listen to what you're saying.
I think in history, typically come back, and there's definitely typically more good than bad. It forces, it forces creative thinking, it forces some innovation, and it forces some change. I mean, and a lot of times they're needed. I mean, when you have to challenge the status quo, you know, that typically can be a very good thing. I mean, and that's great to hear. I mean, and we're hearing that to any of the partners that we work with, that they're just seeing some things, and some communication, and just this enthusiasm for sports. You know, that's at an all-time high. And we really, I know from a BMX side, we're going to work really hard to capitalize on that and grow our sport, get more kids on bikes. And we're excited about the next 2 years. And we're optimistic. We don't feel like we've been held back. We feel like we've been given an opportunity to shine, and we plan to do so.
Yeah, I woke up this morning, I was looking at my calendar and realized this time last year, we were heading to Houston for our Sports ETA board meeting. And so we would normally be in Lansing, Michigan right now, but, you know, that's a positive out of COVID. We'd have to go to Lansing in the middle of winter. But
don't tell Mike Price.
Oh, I tell him all the time. But, I mean, so people that don't know, I've known John for a long time through Sports ETA, which used to be the National Association of Sports Commissions, and we both board members. We both used to represent the rights holders before I came here, but now I'm a destination. And I think that changed my career is when Terry introduced me to this sports tourism thing that I didn't know about. And you've already talked about it, like how it affected BMX, and, you know, now you have partners and things like that. It changed how I saw this as an industry and as a business. And it's, I think we're doing some good work and glad I'm still working with you on that.
It's been a pleasure. I mean, I know when we first met and sat there and started talking, I mean, I knew within about 2 minutes of you and I talking, I said, Matt and I are going to be friends for a long, long time.
Well, it's probably because I made you drink all that bourbon.
but it was funny though, because I think, you know, you and I, you know, speak the same language when we come from a sporting event background and hosting events. And both of us have kind of some unique angles. You know, I mean, you have some extraordinary talents when it comes to organizational planning, thought process, and things of that nature. And that's what, if anybody doesn't know, I mean, Matt on the board for Sports ETA, honestly, for the association, in my opinion, truly has been transformative, you know, because Matt asks the tough questions. He challenges, you know, the thought process, and he thinks differently than a lot of people. And really, it's been so advantageous, because Matt will say something in our board meetings and contribute something, and you're like, wow. But unlike a lot of people where, and you see this in volunteer boards, where some people step up and some people don't. I mean, Matt, you have always stepped up, you know, and taken on tough tasks that need to be accomplished there and contributed. And man, it's just been fun. I mean, I've learned so much from you and just appreciated everything that you've done, you know, for the association. And I think that's a common bond that we have. When we both got into it, A, we didn't expect anything from it. I tell everybody, I feel like I've gotten so much more back and learned so much through the process than I could ever give, that I just feel like I'm just trying to give back to help the association continue to grow so other people like me can be introduced to the association and the industry and learn the things that I've learned and help build the sport that they love and that they're passionate about.
Yeah, I think when we both started on the board, we didn't even have voting rights. I mean, we didn't have a say in an association that we belonged in, and it's, you know, it was baffling to me. And, you know, you were a big advocate with that and getting that change. And I think it changed the way that organization operates. And, you know, we saw it was 2 years ago, I guess now, when we were trying to make bylaw changes. I've never seen people so passionate arguing about bylaws in my life. And bylaws are not interesting by nature. Like, they're not supposed to be. And, like, having people, like, really have heated arguments over bylaws, I was like, wow, like, we've made a difference. Like, if we're doing this, people are like concerned, passionate, and want to be involved. And I think that was a lot different than it was 10 years ago when I got involved with that group.
Without a doubt. I mean, the engagement from both the member level, you know, and the board level is completely different. You know, Al, the CEO there, has done such a great job, you know, in bringing more to the table and more ROI for all of the attendees. And just, you know, for anybody who's never had the privilege of being a part of the association or being really a part of sports tourism, it's amazing. I mean, you take a bunch of people that are so passionate about their own individual sports in general, and you put them in a room where they're sharing all this knowledge, information, experience, and they move mountains. And I mean, and it's the quality of people is what also astounds me. I mean, it's very unique where competitors in cities that are bidding and to host the rights to an event and competing against each other are still communicating and sharing best practices and saying, well, hey, you know, we actually worked with that group. They were amazing. Or, hey, we worked with that group. They really weren't that good. I mean, there's some problems you want to be aware of, and they're kind of protecting, you know, their partners. That's so unusual, you know, within that space, you know, just within business in general. And it's so refreshing when you have the opportunity to work with these guys closely because they love their city. They love their communities and the rights holders. They love their sport. And it's a powerful thing. And I think we keep growing as an industry every single day. And I think that it truly that in 2021 and 22, you know, business travel is never going to be the same again. It's never going to come back like it once was. Sports tourism will lead the way when it comes to the resurgence of tourism. Families are going to get out. We're seeing it in our sport. They don't care about COVID. They want to get their family out there to participate in something that's fun and healthy. And, you know, we're going to see a resurgence. And I think as an industry, we're just going to continue to grow and prosper and become a larger share of tourism than ever before.
Yeah, I think I shocked some of our county council members this year because, you know, Sports ETA did their big research project and really put some money behind, you know, what they were doing. And the results came out and said $43 billion were spent in youth sports in 2019. And you stick that in front of a county council person and say, you know, this is tax money. Like, this is people paying, you know, staying in your hotels and going to your restaurants. And, you know, their ears perk up and like, hey, this is raising money without raising it from our citizens. And it you know, it goes a long way. And it's, you know, now we're talking about having a grant program in our county, something they've never had before, because we gave them numbers and said, hey, you know, we spend $500,000 here and it comes back, you know, tenfold. And they're like, oh, this makes sense. And, you know, I think having a professional industry has made that possible. If, you know, we just said, oh, we have, you know, X number of people come here, but we didn't have dollars behind it, it doesn't go as far as it does. But having the association behind it with some, you know, real strength and saying, hey, we're the leader in this space, it definitely has, you know, more credibility.
And that data that's coming out from the association has been extremely helpful. And again, and that's the storyline, you know, like what you've been able to go in because of that expertise that you bring to the table and bringing that data in front of them. Our story in sports and sports tourism is terrific because the communities that get it right, it's a very, very simple formula. Build world-class facilities that service your families and your children. You know, and when anyone is looking at your community to potentially relocate there, you know, or to do business there, they can come to you and say, wow, look at these facilities these guys have. But then, oh, yeah, by the way, this facility also, because it's so amazing, is going to attract world-class events that bring in taxation that's going to pay for it all. I mean, to me, it's the biggest no-brainer in the communities that are doing it well. It's just they're gobbling up events. I mean, one of the ones I always love to tell everybody to take a look at is go look in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Go look at the facilities that are in this community. That's a suburb community of, you know, Charlotte, North Carolina, across the border there in South Carolina. And these guys have come out. They started with baseball fields and they went and built a soccer complex, you know, and have turf fields. Now they've just built a huge indoor complex. They built one of the best BMX tracks in the world. And said, you know what? We're going to host a world championship. You know, we don't have to be a major community. We can do this, you know, right here and look at what this does for our local kids. And it's great because that's a city where it's parks, recreation, and tourism is one bureau. Now, what a concept. Yeah. Tourism and parks and recreation. Most of the time, park directors and recreational directors often look at tourism and saying, well, those are out-of-towners, that's not our constituents. But hold on, if they're bringing in tax dollars that are funding the facilities for your constituents, now we've got to win. So, you know, people, you know, I love pointing out those examples where they're just doing it so well and so effectively. But then again, I'm seeing families move there because of these type of recreational opportunities and facilities, because the community has prospered because of great facilities and sports stores.
I mean, another one I used to work with was Elizabethtown, Kentucky. I mean,
great example.
Yeah. I mean, you would struggle to find it on a map. And now it's, you know, that's the new suburb of Louisville, even though it's 45 minutes away, because they know how to take care of the community down there. So, but to make you laugh, though, we're the opposite in Montgomery County. So our parks department is different than our recreation department, which is separate from our tourism department. So we have three separate entities there. So that's the uphill battle we fight sometimes. So, all right, I think we kept you long enough. You know, thanks for coming on. And, you know, I think this was a great talk, and look forward to see what you guys have coming up at BMX in the next couple of years.
Opportunity, you know, always love to share the passion about BMX racing. And if you want to get any more information or check out a BMX track near you, just go to usabmx.com.
Yeah. Thank you a lot, sir, and I'll talk to you later.
What if it was possible to get fresh local produce and groceries delivered right to your front door? With all that extra time not worrying about shopping, you'd learn a new language, get a blanket, or even learn to fly. Instacart provides you unlimited grocery delivery for one low, flat monthly fee. There's no separate fee for each time you use the app like their competitors. You choose from multiple local stores, including many that you probably already use. Products are hand-selected by their shoppers to find you fresh ingredients, also protecting your eggs and keeping your bread from getting smashed in the bottom of the bag. You can find everything you normally buy, plus smart suggestions for new items. Instacart will highlight deals to help save you money, with delivery to your door in as fast as 1 hour. You can start your 14-day free trial by following the link in our show notes. Following the link lets Instacart know we sent you and helps us support our show. Instacart. Never step foot in a grocery store again.
Take a time out for Your Health Goals, brought to you by Adventist Healthcare, the premier health system serving your community's needs across the continuum of care.
Hi, I'm Dr. Trey Godwin, a board-certified physician in physical medicine and rehabilitation, as well as sports medicine with Adventist Healthcare Rehabilitation. 2020 was a difficult year for many of us, especially when it came to staying on track with health goals. Because of COVID-19, many people postponed their annual checkups and preventative screenings, letting their healthy habits slide over the past year. This year, take steps to get your health back on track and reset your healthy habits. Make it your priority to not only make healthier choices now, but also be proactive about your health in the future. While many people commonly associate health goals with weight loss, keeping yourself healthy also includes preventative care, as well as finding ways to maintain a positive outlook and managing your mental health. To start, get in touch with your primary care doctor to schedule an appointment. By getting your checkup each year, your primary care doctor can track your overall health and identify problems before they become larger issues. If you don't have a primary care physician, visit AdventistHealthcare.com to find a physician and a location that's near you. Personalized healthcare is improved when you have a meaningful relationship with your primary care doctor. In addition to seeing your doctor, learn your family medical history. Find out what diseases run in your family so you can be aware of what you may be at a higher risk of developing in the future. This way, you can either take specific steps to reduce your risk, or you can begin getting screenings earlier than you normally would. Track your exercise activity by getting a pedometer or a wearable fitness tracker. It is recommended to get about 10,000 steps per day. There are simple changes that you can make to help you achieve your step goals. Some examples include parking farther away from your office entrance. Take the steps inside instead of taking the elevator. and going for a walk during your lunch break. Also, make sure you're getting enough sleep. Unfortunately, despite being critically important for your overall health, sleep is an often overlooked aspect of health. Adults need anywhere from 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night. It's a basic need that will impact all the other areas of your life. Finally, maintain a positive mindset. Your mental health is a big part of your overall health. Being faced with challenges and temporary setbacks is an inevitable part of life. But having a positive attitude will help you combat those challenges and help you stick with your health goals. A large part of your ability to stay healthy comes from how you deal with stress and manage that stress. I hope you find these tips helpful for jumpstarting your health habits for 2021. Remember, be patient, start small, and focus on one change at a time to help you fulfill your goals.
So Kim, you gonna go to BMX bike and start racing now?
Yeah, I think he sold me on it. I mean, I'm still like a little like lost on like the whole sport and like, I mean, he gave us a little like rules tutorial in there where he was like talking about the start of the race. I was like, okay, like I'm starting to understand it, but I'm still like a little lost in the whole BMX thing. But I honestly, that was so cool.
If you race, I'm going to kick a kickball at you.
So that I fall off the bike. Thanks. Appreciate that. No, I will not be racing.
Well, this one, I actually have, and it was because of the relationship with me and John that we actually proposed a program through Sport TTA that was basically like an exchange student, if you would, lack a better term. And it was more like a lot of rights holders, like they only know their sport.
Right.
And like they only know, like we only knew soccer or lacrosse and BMX. And it was one of those things you're like, well, what do other people do? So we started talking about like, hey, why don't we have this exchange program where, you know, you just reach out and say, hey, I want to come see one of your events. And I think I was actually supposed to go to his event in Arundel County because there is a really nice track there.
Yeah.
And I forget what it was. I think he ended up getting moved to like had to go to a different event and like it just fell through. But the program is somewhat stuck and like people now say, hey, I want to come see an event. And you're there as an observer and like they'll put you up in a hotel and make sure you're taken care of. But, you know, you just watch what they do. And it's amazing what people come back and like, I never thought like to do this way. Or, you know, I like how you do registration or – you know, your award ceremony, I took a lot of tips out of that and, you know, we incorporate it in our stuff. And it's one of those you don't know what you don't know thing.
Yeah. I would definitely go to an event. It sounds so much fun.
Yeah. And their events are in cool places too. Like I'm in for the Vegas event. The guy stealing the cookie tray. maybe my favorite story I've ever heard. I've never heard that from him.
I'm going to retell that one. Yeah. I'm going to steal that one because that one was really good.
I can just, in my head, I can see like the hallway in the hotel of just like crumbs, like all the way back to the hotel room. And like, he's like, how did you find me? Like, well, you left a cookie trail.
Yeah. Oh my God. I just want to know like what the, like he said he didn't remember, but like, what was the thought process there? Like, I just can't even imagine.
Hey, the man wanted a cannoli. Yeah,
do what you got to do, I guess.
I talked about that class that me and him taught, and it was, we struggled early on in Sport TTA that the education track wasn't the best, especially from the rights holder standpoint. Cause like they just didn't have people that could speak our language.
Yeah.
And so we just basically went to the board and said, listen, we're going to take over this and we're just going to have rights holders teach rights holder classes. So we did different things. And then John and I combined and said, let's do, you know, emergency planning. And, you know, like I said, it was coming the year after. Do you remember the shooting I'm talking about in Dallas where like somebody was purposely shooting police outside the convention center?
Yes, I do remember that.
So there was a USA fencing and USA volleyball
event in the convention center.
Crazy. So they were under lockdown for God knows how many hours and just couldn't leave. And it sparked them to say, hey, you know, active shooters now like something we need to worry about. So like they started building out their plan and, you know, it became more prevalent, but I don't think people knew how to do it or what to do. And so, you know, John said like, he has something, we had something when I was at Elite and like, you know, let's just get up there and talk. And, you know, we asked that question to Lead and said, how many people have an emergency action plan? And I'm not joking. It was two people raised their hand.
That's so crazy to me.
And, you know, this isn't like 20 years ago. This is like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So it was, like I said, it was shocking. And John said it perfectly. He goes, okay, now I have to recalibrate what I was going to say. Because we're not starting from like, you know, stage three, and we're fine tuning. We're starting at zero and like explaining what an emergency action plan was. And, you know, it was probably one of the most well-received classes, and people were like, hey, can we do more of this? And we realized like, hey, why don't just get the people that do this to talk about it? And that's kind of been our mantra ever since. And, you know, we still bring in professionals and, you know, the academics to talk about different things. But in the end of the day, when you're running events, like you want to hear from other people that run events, like how they do it and why they do it. And, you know, that's where that exchange program came from and said, hey, I want to go see this firsthand. It's one thing to hear about in the classroom, but to actually watch somebody like do what they do. And I was notorious for this, like trying to teach like staff how to do things, like, I wasn't great at it because I just did things.
And, right. And well, like, so I'm the exact same way. I'm not great at training people, but I just learn on the fly. I just try it, figure it out, do it. And I think that's one of the like skill sets that's kind of required for this industry. Like they just kind of throw you in and it's like sink or swim.
Well, I mean, I joke. People always ask me why I bothered to go back to grad school when I went back to Georgetown. And because I was 15 years into the industry at that point. And I was like, honestly, the best thing I got out of it was teaching people what I do and how I do it. And it made me think about why I do things. And there was things I was like, that's dumb. Why do I do it that way? And like when I try to explain it, I was like, yeah, that's dumb. Like I need to fix that. And I think that was my biggest takeaway. And you've met Jason Poppy, the AD at Georgetown. He was one of the teachers in that program. And he always jokes that he learned more from me than I learned from him. And I was like, probably because I've been doing it longer. And he's like, yeah, you're probably right. And, you know, it was interesting to do that. And I think having been doing this for 21 years now, like I enjoy being able to teach people what I do and how I do it. And as John said, I think it helps everybody. You know, if we get better at what we do and we teach somebody else how to be better, in the long run, everyone gets better across the industry. Because if you're not doing it the right way, you're not going to survive.
Yeah. I think one of the cool things that like came out of this interview that John said too was how much COVID has impacted their sport in particular, just because I think, like we said, it's one of the safer sports, I think, that's out there that can be played during this time.
It's like tennis.
But then like the amount of work and how he literally said the work that they've done to get those events happening during the pandemic saved their sport. I thought that was a pretty cool thing that he said. Because I think that that's probably the case, that there's definitely that's one of the benefits of the pandemic is that things have gotten attention put on them that otherwise probably might not have had it.
Yeah, I mean, not to be a shot at BMX, but, you know, it's just not a popular in the culture sport. You don't see it on TV. Like, you should, like, the people, and honestly, I do the same thing. I think of the X Games when I think of BMX.
Same.
And, you know,
like the Dew Tour.
But it's been an Olympic sport since 2008. Like, we're talking 12 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I think them being able to be still out there and doing the sport, it shows why they had growth, because people are looking for anything for their kids to do. So if they can go put them on the bike. And I should have asked him this. I don't know if it's a fuzzy connection, but do you think the rise of Peloton like impacts them at all? Like the parents are on a bike, the kids want to ride a bike.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I could be reaching at straws on that one, but
I don't know. I feel like Peloton is like the result of like spin class. So I don't know if that translates to BMX, but I think you're probably right, is that people are thinking outside the box.
I mean, you see that 5-year-old kid watches their mom and dad on a Peloton bike and just wants to ride a bike. You're not going to put the kid on a, you know, $1,200 Peloton or $2,000 Peloton.
Well, they can't reach the pedals, I don't think.
But you can go buy them a Strider bike or, you know, a balance bike or something like that. So I don't know. Maybe there is a connection there. I'll email and ask them.
There you go. Give us a follow up.
Yep. So how was the new year?
New year was good. I mean, I'm hoping for a better 2021 for sure. I think 2020 was a struggle for all of us. And like you mentioned today, our 2021 event calendar is looking pretty good. So yeah, I'm just
you're
hoping.
You're not getting the day off. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's okay. After, you know, 2020, I think I'm ready to get back out there. So I'm just hoping.
Should we just give you off for February so you're prepped for the rest of the year? Does that work out?
Yeah, sure.
Swap days.
I'm not sure if it's like an exchange like that, but sure.
Well, it should be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
It can't be any worse than it was. So.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that 2021 is, you know, greener pastures ahead. That's what I'm hoping for.
Well, it's good to get back in the office. Good to get back on the podcast.
Absolutely.
We have some more episodes coming up for you. So make sure you tune in and If you haven't listened to the old episodes, please go back and do it. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Pitchside from the Plex podcast. Head to mdsoccerplex.org to check out other episodes. Follow us at MD Soccerplex on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Be sure to join us again soon. Pitchside from the Plex is produced by Matt Liver and Alexis Andrew Cat Price, with support from Kim Walter and Gary Burke.